With new AI models and tools coming out on a weekly basis, we're starting to wonder whether businesses and consumers are facing an AI overload. In addition, news reports of AI still making some big errors has us concerned about the development of artificial intelligence. We'll take the pulse of how we're feeling about AI on this episode of Today in Tech. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Today in Tech. I'm Keith Shaw. Joining me on the show today is Rebecca Parsons. She is the CTO Emerita at ThoughtWorks. Welcome to the show, Rebecca.
Happy to be here.
And you've been in the AI space for a long time, even way before like last year when generative AI took off. So you've been an IT veteran in the space. So thank you again for being on the show. When we talked before the show, we were talking about a lot of these new AI models and companies that keep emerging in the space, as well as new features and some other things that AI can do. For example, I think OpenAI just released some tools for AI video, which hadn't been around for a while. And then, you know, we realize that we're still in the early stages, but I'm wondering if there's a feeling that we're being bombarded with technology that still may or may not work. I'm wondering what the feeling is out there in the people that you work with.
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to really not knowing what the best way is to take advantage of some of these. And quite frankly, also, just like any technology, you've got the people who are trying to use it in the way that everybody expects it to be used, but we're hearing more and more about how different people who are kind of the black hats are starting to attempt to hack into these models to get them to do the things that we're trying to have guardrails around so that they won't do.
Right.
And so we are getting more and more capabilities, and there's still a lot of exploration that needs to be done on what are the ways we can get the most value from these.
Do you feel that businesses and consumers, even to that effect, need to stay aware of all of these new products and tools that are coming out? Do they have a responsibility to do their research on that, or can they pick and choose and say, all right, I think we'll just kind of pick the ones that I might know about, or the ones that look good or that sound good to me? I'm just curious about how much of a responsibility should be on the businesses, because again, it's like when you go to the grocery store and you have floods and floods of cereal to choose from, for example. Like, you know, you pick your favorite, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's part of it. I mean, different people are using these in different ways. I just read about a particular tool that makes it easy to take a short story and have it be illustrated. And that is tying together a lot of the individual capabilities. Well, for some people, that's something that they really want to do.
Yeah.
Doesn't really float my boat, but, you know, and so I think what we are going to see is more and more of these scripted tools and integrations that are solving for specific problems. And people, individual consumers, I think it should be driven by, this is what I would like to accomplish. Whereas for businesses, I think they have more of a responsibility, particularly if they're going to be doing these integrations, to be aware of what the options are, and they will have to do more to try to keep up with things.
Right. So when you talk with businesses and clients about discussing their concerns around AI in its current state that we're in, we're about a year and a half into the big generative AI push and the hype. For example, there was a recent MIT Technology Review survey that found 75% of companies and business leaders said they were experimenting with AI. But when you got down to the how many are actually significantly using the technology, that number dropped to 9%. So it feels like that something is holding these companies back. And like, have you been able to determine what might be holding a lot of companies back at this point?
Well, I think there are a few things. One is, particularly generative AI is inherently non-deterministic. if you ask the same question twice, you are not necessarily going to get the same answer. And depending on what you're trying to accomplish, that's either really good because it's being creative and opening up ideas, or it's very bad because you actually want to get the same answer to the question. And so I think that that's part of it. There was actually quite a good article in The Economist recently that you really can't do generative AI without hallucinations. It's just not possible, or at least not with the technology as it exists right now.
And so that probably scares business leaders like to,
oh,
to,
yeah.
You know, that is like, we can't have that. We need, I've spoken with a lot of other people that talk about accuracy and obviously if I ask what a math question, I'm hoping to get the same answer every time. But when I'm asking it to draw, you know, someone on a horse, yeah, I want to see different options.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think another aspect of this, because there is so much that isn't well understood about how this technology is really working and what it's actually doing, it's hard to know what is the basis upon which, you know, a particular answer is coming.
Mm-hmm.
And are there biases in there? As a business, if I say deploy some AI tool to help screen resumes, and it's decided that all computer scientists are white men,
right,
then it's not, it is my problem as a business because I'm now discriminating.
Right, right.
But if I don't know that, you know, how am I supposed to protect myself? So, you know, I think there are issues around bias and explainability that is probably going to stop some businesses from wanting to deploy these things.
Right, right. So the other thing that I think we talked about before the show as well was whether or not we're still in this kind of AI gold rush where we will still see more and more companies coming out with tools. We'll see more, you know, especially as OpenAI and some other companies open up their models, and then you start seeing other third-party tools that come out. There's some really good ones on OpenAI, for example. But with any kind of gold rush or land rush, you're going to get messy results sometimes. And so maybe I'm overreacting by this overload, by just not understanding that we're still in the early stages and these things happen in the early stages of technology. Is it my problem, or is it something that we need to be aware of?
Probably a little bit of both, but I do think it's more a real phenomena.
Yeah.
Because we are definitely in an exploratory phase, and there's a lot of experimentation going on. And the thing about experiments, it's not really an experiment if you know what's going to happen. And so we really are in this exploratory, experimental phase. And some of these things are going to work really well, and some of these things are not going to work very well at all. And it's somewhat difficult to predict. And, you know, that's the whole basis of an experiment is you're trying to learn something that you don't know and hasn't been known before. So I do think that there is a lot of uncertainty as a result of just the sheer level of experimentation and people trying new things and people trying to differentiate and, oh, well, if OpenAI can do this, then what does Gemini need to do? And you know, that is... you know, the land rush aspect of this is, you know, what constitutes the floor before you start differentiating keeps getting higher and higher.
Right. And a lot of these experiments and the pilot programs that companies will put out, you can't necessarily know that those results are going to be the right answers, because once you release it to the public has so many different, you know, good guys, bad guys, you know, up, down, left, right, where in a pilot program, it's a little bit more of a controlled experience. Right. And so I think a lot of these examples that come out are, you know, the ones that get the headlines are because of public experiments or the public using these tools. Now, there are other reasons why some of these things failed, but maybe we as the tech media might be too hard on these tools because they're making some pretty outrageous mistakes. We should realize, well, at least we discovered the mistake before someone got hurt or injured or something like that, right?
Well, and also because the breadth of usage is so vast, how in the world is, you know, somebody who's putting out a model or putting out a product, how are they going to be able to anticipate? I mean, these large language models and things like ChatGPT, they're supposed to be able to converse across, you know, an enormous range of topics.
Right.
So how you can't test that. And one of the things we as technologists in general are very bad at predicting all of the different ways people will use our stuff that we didn't anticipate. We're just not good at it because
right.
we see a problem.
Then you go and try to fix it, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and we're going to go solve that problem. And this person over here is thinking, oh, well, I can do this instead. And it is very difficult to anticipate. And I think it's worse in this context just because the technology is so incredibly approachable. Anybody can say anything it wants to ChatGPT. You have no way of knowing what people are going to be putting in next.
So what are your biggest concerns then about maybe the potential consequences of this overload or this land rush that is happening? I have my concerns, but I want to see what you guys are thinking about when you talk to your colleagues at ThoughtWorks and as you're exploring the landscape, is it just that the wrong technology might be adopted as the standard, or is it something else with, you know, the possibility of more and more errors coming out?
Well, I think,
or is it something else? It could be another thing. Yeah.
I try to start from what are the consequences for the particular uses that this is being put to if something goes wrong. I distinctly remember a day long time ago when you used to get all these things in the mail because you didn't have recommendation engines. And on the same day, I got a catalog for new mothers and an invitation to join the American Association of Retired Persons. And I was in my early 30s.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
yeah.
So maybe some trees died that didn't need to die. But the consequence of getting that recommendation wrong, I had a couple more things to throw away.
Right.
Because actually I was interested in neither of them. The potential for this technology to be used in healthcare, in the legal system, in our criminal justice system, in financial planning, the consequences of getting it wrong are much greater.
Right.
And when you look inherently at how this technology works, it is more likely to get something wrong in a weird or subtle way, which for a recommendation engine is not a problem unless it's a recommendation engine for, you know, an invasive surgery that you may end up not needing.
Right. If a lot of these errors and inaccuracies continue, though, does that also then lead to an erosion of trust from the end users and consumers? And like, how can we estimate on how long do we give them kind of the slack before we start saying, all right, this thing isn't working, we really got to get this accuracy solved?
Yeah, and I think that, again, varies based on what the application is, but I do think there is loss of trust from the consumer side, but also loss of trust, you know, from the business perspective.
Right.
Some of the creative ways things have gone wrong for people who have been using this as a customer service chatbot, and now they're being held liable for things because it made it up.
Right.
Oh, we don't have this policy. Well, it decided we do.
Yeah.
And so the organizations have to decide what is their level of trust, what kind of monitoring do they want to put in place, but also consumers. And we did a consumer study a while ago, and the percentage of people who assume that businesses are going to misuse their information was already high. And now, you know, with Copilot, there are lawsuits about misappropriation of intellectual property. Artists are doing the same things in terms of, you know, replicating a style. And so you have both the trust of the consumers and, A, do I approve of how you were how you're going about your business, but also, you know, am I getting the value that I want from this? And then conversely, the brand impact from the business side when these things go wrong.
Yeah, I have another example of that where the folks at Meta, they're the ones that do Facebook, Instagram, all that. There was a story about some vice president was announcing all of this investment they were doing in AI chips. And the goal was to integrate a lot of their video platform tools. They have separate ones and they were going to integrate them all. And then they were going to add AI and it was going to become a better recommendation engine for people watching videos. And my first reaction was not of, wow, this is great, I can't wait to see what's happened. My first reaction was, I don't want Meta knowing this stuff. And I don't, you know, there's always this cloud around Meta and how much data they already have on me. So I don't need more recommendations. The fact that you know, I like watching beagle videos because I have a beagle at home. So, you know, I don't really need them to know that. And, you know, there are certain things in my life I don't want a giant big tech company. So I think they were thinking, hey, this is great. But because of that potential trust issue, it might not go the way they want to go. Are we already seeing that erosion of trust, I guess?
We're certainly seeing that in places.
Yeah.
I know many technologists who will not use Messenger. They will not use Facebook. They will not use any of those products because they don't trust Meta.
Yeah.
And you know, there are similarly people who turn off all tracking in their browsers because they don't want any of that data going anywhere because they don't trust what people are going to use it for. And what is very often misunderstood is just how much you can learn if you put together disparate knowledge sources.
Right.
There was one example where a lawyer was in a courtroom and was arguing about the misuse of metadata. And the judge was basically saying, oh, you can't learn anything from that data. And so the lawyer came in the next day and read off all of these things about the judge's family.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, the judge was going to, you know, cite him for contempt of court.
Yeah.
Until he said, but you said yesterday that you can't learn anything of importance from this data. And people don't realize, when everything used to be scattered in file folders, it didn't matter that these two pieces of information were part of the public record, because how in the world were those two pieces of information ever going to meet? But now they meet all of the time, and there's so much you can learn. And people are starting to recognize that, and that's why I think that this is becoming more and more of an issue.
And this was developed with algorithms that had nothing to do with the current state of AI tools, right?
Exactly.
So
exactly.
I think if we then went and said to the next level of, well, now these tools are smarter and these large language models are even better, that would cause me to be a little bit scared too.
Yes.
So
yes.
I want to switch gears just a second. One of the other things that concerns me is from the marketing side of things and the business side of things, the one, you know, the companies that already have tools out there, and as they try to get other companies to use their models or use their tools, do we have the potential of having an AI situation that is similar to the VHS versus Betamax? To go back like 40 years, that's how old I am. I remember the whole VHS versus Betamax wars, but we could talk other technologies that you know, there might be a tool out there that is so much better, but because company A or company B has the marketing power and marketing to convince you that theirs is better, it might not be. But are we going to end up in a situation where we have a Betamax AI that nobody uses?
There's certainly the potential for that. And and part of why there's been concern about the consolidation in the tech industry is the fact that you might have this great innovation that happens in this small company, and rather than try to compete, they might gobble up the company, or just as you say, out market them. Because unfortunately, the best technology does not always win, regardless of what people like me would like for the world to be. You know, the best technology should actually win.
Yeah, that's my tech optimism there too, Rebecca. It's like that. Yeah, I always want the best technology to win, but now I've been here long enough to know that that's not always the case.
Yeah, and sometimes there are legitimate reasons for it, because there are concerns potentially outside the realm of just pure technology prowess. But that's more often within an organization. You know, for example, you know, an organization that has a huge software development capability might want to standardize on a platform just so that their workforce is more fungible, as opposed to, well, in this particular case, for this little tiny thing, if I use this technology, I could do it so much better. But then now you have to maintain that technology.
Yeah. So, is it like, if you had to rank where that concern would be with this whole Betamax VHS thing, is it kind of lower on the list? Obviously, there's bigger hurdles, right?
Yeah, I think it's lower on the list, and in part because if there is truly better technology out there, okay, maybe the original creators of it aren't necessarily going to be able to reap the huge benefits that, you know, a Microsoft or an OpenAI has managed to reap. But given the potential for this technology, you know, the Microsofts and the AI, the OpenAIs and the Googles of the world, they're not going to ignore a technology that is vastly superior.
Yeah.
And so there is less likelihood of it being buried. That is one of the differences. You really did have to pick between VHS and Betamax.
Right.
Because, you know, okay, is everybody going to put out two versions of their movie or series? So one had to win.
Okay.
Software is a whole lot more malleable than that.
Okay.
And, you know, unless it's a completely contradictory model, the dominant model could incorporate whatever that innovation was that was making it better.
Well, that makes me feel a lot better now. So thank you for that. I was worried that we were going to have like a generic AI tool, but you're right. You could pick and choose depending on the situation that you want. Kind of like how you can pick, you know, Google for your email and some, you know, Microsoft or something else. You don't have to pick one versus the other, I guess, anymore. You had mentioned explainability earlier in the discussion here, and I'm wondering, why does the AI community still have a problem with explainability? My guess is that, like, have we become so enamored with the magic of AI that you know, part of us doesn't want to see how the magic trick is made? Or, you know, it's like when you're watching a magician, sometimes you enjoy the magic. And then there are people that want to know how it works. But I think with AI, getting the AI to explain why it made the decision it did in those types of things, we're still struggling with that, aren't we?
Yes, yeah. We are. Strides are being made. And there are situations, particular techniques are more amendable to explainability than others. One of my favorite examples of this was a teaching hospital and they were trying to determine a model for when you might, after a particular procedure, put somebody into the intensive care unit. And they trained two different models. One was very accurate, but you couldn't really parse the parameters and figure out how the decision was actually being made. And they used another technique on the same training data. It wasn't quite as accurate, but it was very easy to see the logic. In this particular case, it was good that they did, because their data set did not include any people who had asthma, because they always automatically went into the ICU. And so neither one of the models said anything about asthma. And so you could have had people dying because they needed to be put into the ICU because they were asthmatic. And they could tell that from the model that was easier to understand. And there are techniques where you can probe models and try to discern, okay, these two situations are different in this way, and I get a different kind of result, and then I can infer decision making. The scale of what the parameters and just the sheer breadth of the kinds of answers makes explainability more of a problem, I think, with our current crop.
Yeah, and is the explainability issue mainly because when they get results that are hallucinations, rather than, like, you don't need an AI to explain why it said 2 plus 2 was 4, right? But if it came out with 2 plus 2 is 9, you're like, okay, well, how did you come up with that? Like, we need explainability when it goes kooky. But, or do we need explainability on everything?
Well, again, it goes back to how are you using it? You know, if you are using it to interrogate some documents for a legal opinion, you might want to know the rationale for that opinion, regardless of whether it seems to make sense or not. As a creator of the model, I might want to focus on, okay, why did it just say 2 plus 2 equals 9?
Yeah.
As a user of the model, you know, if it's, okay, this is relevant case law, well, why? If it is going to go through a process to determine this is relevant, I probably want to know why it thinks it's relevant and how confident it is of that relevance.
Yeah.
And so even if it's not kooky, as a user, I still want to know.
Yeah, the closest thing I see with explainability on ChatGPT when I'm doing text-based questions is they'll just include the link of the story that they determined. But that still doesn't answer, like, well, how do you know that that story was accurate in the first place? Or, you know, and then it starts to become like a footnote type of thing. It's like, well, I can't remember how many footnotes I've read in... You know, back in the day when I was taking constitutional law, yeah, you have to read the footnotes because that's where they put all of the case law that they're defending. But in a news article, it's like, okay, I guess it was accurate, or they have a ranking system and you just have to trust that the articles as the data set was accurate in the first place, right? Yeah.
Well, we've been suffering from that problem. Well, the internet says it's true.
I mean, well, it must be true. It's on the internet, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that just isn't that isn't a sound basis for evaluation. And that's going to take us on a whole nother tangent.
Yeah. So you do think that the explainability issue will get solved then in the future, or quickly, or is it going to take a while?
I think we're going to continually improve upon explainability. But I don't think the problem is going to be solved anytime soon, but I think it will get better.
Okay.
And I think as people also start to see why explainability is important, you can also start making determinations like that model at the teaching hospital. You know, they gave up a little bit of accuracy for a lot of explainability. Well, maybe that's good enough.
Yeah.
Because if you've got good explainability and reasonable accuracy, well, since it's explaining, you can notice, oh, wait a minute, you know, that kind of went haywire.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, no model is perfect. Hopefully models are useful, but no model is perfect. And so even if you've got a highly accurate model, it's still going to get it wrong sometimes.
Yeah.
And if you don't know what the parameters of when it might get something wrong, you're just going to blindly assume that it's right all of the time.
When you're seeing a lot of these stories about AI and, you know, they're making errors in some of the responses that they come out, are a lot of these mainly just because these companies didn't keep the human in the loop? And maybe that's where those companies should have made sure that a human was reviewing these answers? Or is it just like, even with a human in the loop, sometimes you're going to get some of those outliers?
Well, yeah, I mean, we're all fallible because we're all human. But
are we sure that everybody's human?
Well, there are a couple. that scene from Men in Black comes to mind.
Right, right.
I always thought she was a little weird. I do think a lot of them are the result of a human not being in the loop. But you have pressure there. I mean, when you think of the customer service examples, the whole reason they're deploying this chatbot is so that they don't need to have a human in the loop. And in that case, it's probably as much about not having the right kind of guardrails around than it is not having a human in the loop. Because if we're going to automate things, by definition, that means eventually the human is going to be taken out of the loop or
right.
kept in the loop for those recognizable edge cases. If you can automate, you know, 95% of things, and then the expert gets to spend their time looking at the 5% that are anomalous in some ways.
Right.
You've improved the quality of life for the expert because they're not sorting through, you know, blindingly obvious things. They're being able to use their human capabilities. And so this is sort of my nirvana state is, you know, humanity augmented. You know, let the computers do the easy stuff and figure out how to recognize when it's not easy so that I can pull a person into the loop to say, actually, you know, somebody who can think more creatively or behave more empathetically or
right,
whatever
right.
human skill we're drawing
and that's,
on.
That's the big issue that I think a lot of people miss when they talk about AI and jobs and replacement and automation, things like that. Like, you know, you're just automating the really dull stuff or the stuff that's repetitive and, you know, give those humans a chance to really focus, like you said, on the tougher issues. I wanted to ask a question about, you know, you've been in the AI space, and this, I don't even know if this is a great question or not, but when you're talking about AI, is it better to have a small group of people working on it and developing the algorithm and making it smarter, or is it better to have a large group of people maybe working on the tool? It's that whole issue of, you know, how many cooks do you need in the kitchen to stir the pot type of a thing. Is it bad if you start getting more and more people looking at something to try to fix something? I don't know. Or is it not even applicable?
Well, I think I think you need to separate out sort of the core technology from the way you might improve the technology. If you think back to the AI system that figured out how to play Go, it figured that out by playing against itself
mm-hmm.
and learning strategies that way and ended up with a strategy that most human Go players would never have attempted.
Right.
And so there can be benefits from restricting access to the training.
Okay.
so that we don't bring in our own human biases. I was at a talk years ago about genetic programming, and they had used genetic programming to develop a quantum operator, a basic operator for quantum computing. And all of the quantum scientists said, well, I never would have thought of that. but because because the humans were not biasing it, it came up with a solution that, because our minds are preconditioned for how we're trained and scientists, et cetera. So I think when you're establishing the core, you probably do want restrictions. One of the interesting things, though, about what large language models in particular have done is we are getting an explosion of potential uses because it is so easy for people to access. But they're not touching the underlying model.
Right.
They're interacting with it and developing things on top of it. And so I think there is definite power in that broadening of the workforce for how we might use this and how we might bring different things together to do different things.
Right, right.
But I think the core technology, you know, that's still, I think, going to be controlled by a very small.
Is that why you see a lot of those core technologies being developed by startups versus some of these larger companies like, you know, Google and some of these big companies? Could a big company like that do the type of work that these other ones are doing, and then that's why they end up buying or investing in some of these? I think Microsoft is an example of that.
Yeah, and I think it's the same dynamic. It's not specific to AI in this context.
You could talk about this for any innovation, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Large enterprises have immune systems that will tend to reject things that go after the cash cow or, you know, are something radically different. And so I don't think in this context AI is any different.
Okay. Than that. All right. Thanks for answering that. That's been bugging me for a while. All right. So with all of these issues around AI and the errors and accuracies and, you know, let's just take the pulse. Are we feeling good about the technology as a whole, or, you know, is it too soon to start being critical of some of these incidents, or, you know, have we not yet found the new shiny ball to go chasing after? Like, what's your take on where we are 15, 16 months into this?
I think we're still learning the potential. I sometimes worry I come off too negative.
That's okay.
But I do see real potential in this. Some of the work they've been doing in drug discovery using, you know, variants of large language models could radically alter the entire process of how we bring new drugs to market. And by changing the price point, we might finally start to be able to address, you know, diseases that are still existing in poor parts of the world, but aren't a problem in the U.S. or Europe, and so nobody worries about them. We're still learning all of the different ways we can use this technology, and so I don't think it's. I personally am not worried about the paperclip maximizing artificial intelligence, which is going to devour the world because it is programmed to make the maximum number of paperclips. I'm not worried about that, at least not in my lifetime.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do think that this is a technology that is doing things that is unexpected. And we need to be thoughtful about how we deploy it, but I think we also do have to experiment and learn. You know, what are the ways that we can bring value to the world using this technology, because I do think it has enormous potential.
Yeah, I think that the best way to approach a lot of things in life, and it includes in this one, is if you are too much of an optimist, you get accused of being like a fanboy of something. Mm-hmm. If you disagree with something too much, you become a hater. And you know, you can't be either. You kind of have to play that middle of like, I'm optimistic, but I'm also, I want to question things, and I don't want to, you know, so I don't want to be seen as too critical, but I also don't want to be seen as too rah-rah. And that's kind of where I play it. And I think more and more there's fewer of us out there that are trying to be right down the middle on whatever topic you want to talk about, right?
Yeah, I consider myself a tech pragmatist.
There you go. That's a great term. I'm going to start using that if I can. All right, Rebecca Parsons from ThoughtWorks, thank you so much for being on the show and talking about all these issues. Great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
That's all the time we have for today's episode. Don't forget to like the video, subscribe to the channel, add any comments that you have below. Join us every week for new episodes of Today in Tech. I'm Keith Shaw. Thanks for watching.